talk about this whole ass-kicking thing, and maybe share some share with some people, you know, what you and I have talked about, chatted about through Skype, because you know I like to share the knowledge that you've shared with me. So I figured if we could do that, record it and see what
knowledge
happens.
So much as attitude, but what do you have in mind?
Just kind of talking about, well, I'd actually like to talk about, one, why you started that whole thing to begin with. And then two, I mean, I guess just to put into audio the attitude that you shared with me, in chat in regards to, you know, submissions and how you submit and how you find, places to submit and that kind of thing. 'Cause, you know, I know there are a lot of people that are taking part in it, at least they signed up to, but they haven't really done much, and I don't know if that's because maybe they don't know what to do or they're reluctant for some reason.
I'm sure a lot of it has to do with my stuff's not good enough to get bought yet, so,
but we'll see.
Because, I mean, you know, it's just, it's unfortunate that people are reluctant. And, I mean, I've started submitting more and more stuff. You know, I've submitted more stuff thanks to this than I've submitted in the past, you know, ever since I've been writing.
Yeah.
So what you've done for me has been tremendous in this whole, this whole thing.
Well, that's exactly the effect I was hoping it would have, so.
All right,
yeah, so, sure, let's go for it. Kitty's puttering around in the background here, so there will be noise. It's not studio perfect. It's
that's
too hot.
Fine. That's
for
fine.
That.
That is quite all right. So I guess first, just tell me what got you started in this whole idea of putting together the literary ass-kicking contest, if you want to call it that.
Well, the germ of it was I read a rant by Dean Wesley Smith about Heinlein's rules and how nobody follows them. Which is ironic, since Heinlein was one of the most successful science fiction writers in history.
Right.
And he wrote these rules specifically for new writers who were trying to break in. And nobody follows them until much later in their career when they figure out, oh yeah, he was onto something, huh?
Amazing.
And I include myself in that. The thing that has always intimidated me about the market is not the rejection slips. It's being rejected before they ever read the story, right?
Yeah.
Because I, you know, enough of a business head that I understand this. I don't like this story, or it's not right for my magazine or my publishing company. But I've just got this terminal fear of, oh, this guy called me Ms. in the cover letter instead of Mrs. Fuck him.
Right?
Which is absolutely irrational, and I understand that. But nonetheless, it kept me back for quite a while. So I'm reading this rant. And if you haven't read any of Dean Wesley Smith's rants, you do have to wear an asbestos suit.
Is that the guy that you've sent me links to where he's killing...
killing the sacred cows?
Killing the sacred cows? Yeah, yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah, he makes... Well, you've seen me at Balticon on a rant where I was ranting about something that pissed me off. Dean Wesley Smith makes me look like a mild-mannered kindergarten teacher.
Nice.
He's kind of like Harlan Ellison without the role play of being the conceited spoiled child that Harlan does.
Gotcha.
Which worked really well for Harlan when he was our age. Doesn't work so well for him now that he's 80.
Right.
But you know. But yes, Dean is a very opinionated guy and not embarrassed about it, but also very good at explaining his opinions. So when you disagree with him, you know exactly why, right? You don't just disagree with him because he's acerbic and abrasive.
Right.
So he was writing this rant, I believe it was part of the Sacred Cows series, actually, about how writers rewrite their shit to death, remove all trace of their original voice from the work, and then usually don't send it out. And then they wonder why they can't make a living with their writing. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, he's kind of got a point. And at that point, I'd already been approached independently for two different publications of my fiction from people that kind of stumbled onto my shit in the podosphere.
Right.
I had people coming to me. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. If people are coming to me, at least some of the stuff I'm writing must be of professional quality. Therefore, I'm a moron because I'm not mailing shit out.
Yes.
And so I sat and I thought for a long time about why I wasn't, and it came back to the market thing, because I've got no problem mailing queries out for nonfiction because I know how nonfiction works. I don't really know, and even now I'm sure I don't really know how fiction works, even though I feel like I've got a better handle on it after getting, you know, a little bit, 10 rejection notices this summer.
Right.
And having a couple of good exchanges with editors over the last couple of years. Actually, more than that. But anyway, so I feel a little more confident in what I've got going on, but I'm sure I don't know the half of it. But I realized that it was that fear of the unknown that had been keeping me back, and knowing me, I needed to somehow incentivize the process of sending stuff out to get rejected. Which is what you do when you're putting it on the market. You're not sending something out for sale. You're sending something out to get rejected, because the only way you know where it's going to sell is by having it bounced from all the places that aren't going to buy it, right?
Right.
Right.
It's much more like the scientific method than it is like a seduction.
Hmm.
Well, let's see what this market does. My hypothesis is that they will reject the shit out of it. Let's conduct some experiments, weighting the cover letter as heavily as we can to get the negative result, and if we do, we'll move on to the next market. And I thought if I could get an incentive for myself beyond, you know, like ticklers on my calendar or having my partner annoy me about it, then I would be more likely to start selling sooner rather than later, which has kind of been my goal in life since I was 8 years old, is to make a living off my writing,
right,
off my fiction writing. Right.
Yeah.
Someone in the comments for one of the posts where Dean was ranting about this asked him a question, and he mentioned that when he was trying to get into the habit of sending stuff out onto market and writing regularly, he set up a bet with a couple other writer friends about who could send off the most stories in a year. And I thought, well, that is an idea. I will make a public bet. I will bet the universe. And so I set up the ass moving contest at AnMap, which, because of the ass moving contest, I haven't had a lot of time to actually do anything else with. But hey, it's a good pilot project.
It is.
I said, okay, everyone, by the time next Balticon rolls around, I will have submitted more stories, articles, and novels for publication than you will. And I'll bet you $10. And we got about 14 people so far who've taken the bet. And so it's on the honor system, right? Because I don't want to have to deal with keeping money in escrow.
Yeah.
So there's a point scoring system. Fiction short stories are worth 3 points. Novel submissions are worth 4. Nonfiction article submissions are worth 1, I think,
because
you're still practicing submitting, but it's the thing that it's not the thing that scares me, right? So,
right.
I don't want to be able to cheat.
And
with
it's all about you, and
right? Well, it is. Well, that's the way it started. But I also didn't want to be in a position where I was winning by cheating by just doing what I do normally with my nonfiction articles.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But I figured it wasn't fair not to put them on there at all, because some other people might have, you know, might be wanting to get into the nonfiction market as well. So.
Well, and I mean, even that part of it was nice, because it made me at least, you know, put out a few feelers about nonfiction articles. Because personally, I've only made any money from my writing, and the money that I've made has been in nonfiction, but it's all been nonfiction that somebody approached me with and said, hey, I want to pay you to write this.
Right.
And that doesn't happen very often to anybody unless they're, you know, already making it. So those are very special incidences. So I really wanted to, you know, start trying that too. So that's really been a good incentive for me to do the nonfiction thing. So all the way around, this has been good. So I don't know who's going to hear this besides me and you, but to anybody that's listening to this, that's a writer of any kind, I encourage you, if you're not submitting because of whatever reason, you should go
join the contest.
Join the contest. Heck yeah, more money for me.
The contest is open for joining by anyone at any time between now and the deadline. But the catch is that only the stories and articles that you submit after you announce that you're joining the bet count.
Yes. Yes.
And that includes sales. So like if you submitted a novel and then said, "Oh, wait, maybe I should join the ass moving contest." And then you sold the novel afterwards, you don't get points for that sale, because you, at least not for that sale to that publisher. If it got rejected and you submitted again to another publisher after you joined, then that submission and that sale would count.
Right.
But the scores are still pretty low for the way the point system's set up. I think I've got 64 because I just sent off a whole blast of novel submissions. And Scott, I think you're next with like 25 or something. I don't have the scoreboard in front of me. But you can find all of this at nmap-foundation.org.
I think I'm in the low 30s, but you might be right.
Okay.
In any case, yeah, I was well ahead for a little while there. And then all of a sudden, I checked the scoreboard and you were like, boom. And actually, that's something else I wanted to talk to you about. Because as soon as I saw that, I was like, okay, wait a minute. How do I jump like that? And so what you had done was first of all, you have a number of larger completed works, but you submitted each one of those to multiple venues.
And right. Each one of them went out to five so far. I'm prepping the next round for another five.
So here was my question to you, and your answer interested me enough to want to ping you to record this. Ordinarily, all the publishers that I've been looking at have said no unagented manuscripts, and mm-hmm. two, no simultaneous submissions. And for people that are listening to this that aren't quite sure what that means, one, they don't want you to submit a manuscript as the writer. They want an agent to submit it. And two, they want that agent to submit it only to them and to no one else at the same time. So,
right. By the way, that's bullshit.
Okay. So that's what I want you to address. I want you to tell people why that is bullshit, and what as we as writers should be aware of, so that we can have the maximum opportunity to get our stuff published or rejected, as the case may be.
So we'll start with the multiple submission thing, because you said that agents only submit to one at a time. That's not true. Agents submit to everybody if they're doing their job, and if they're not doing their job properly, which unfortunately, because of the nature of the profession, a lot of them don't. They will submit to one and then ignore you. The last survey I saw said something around the average number of rejections an agented manuscript gets is four before it's pulled from the market, which is a problem when things like Harry Potter got 19 before it was picked up.
Right.
So that's reason number one that I am not starting this whole round of shenanigans with an agent. I've met and know personally and quite like two or three agents who I would never be able to work with on a long-term basis. Our working styles are simply too dissimilar. But I can and will pull them in when I need to negotiate a contract on a piecemeal basis. As their availability dictates. But a good agent actually submits to the universe and says fuck it, and the first person back either gets the contract or starts the bidding war. And there's several people that we both know who have been in bidding war situations because of that, which is a very, very nice situation to be in.
Yes, yes.
As far as no unagented submissions, evidently there are a few people who really mean it. I've run into a couple of them and been quite shocked. Lou Anders, for example, really means it. He's it's probably because he's completely flooded right now, being that he's the new guy on the block with a hell of a reputation, and he's running a very small press.
And for those who may not be familiar with who that is, including myself,
Pyre Books.
Okay.
But he's very cordial about it, very very professional guy. But at the moment, he's only looking at unagented submissions in certain genres. So, you know, for what it's worth. But on the whole, to back up a couple of steps, if you're a publisher and you're in the business of finding the next big thing and getting it out on the market, the last thing you're going to want to do is hand the success of your business and your ability to discover talent before your competitors do over to a group of people who are unregulated, unlicensed, and anyone can be a literary agent. There are no laws about it. The last thing you're going to want to do is have your business held hostage to the tastes of of people who call themselves literary agents. But you can use them as screens for the gullible. And let's face it, the majority of stuff that comes in on slush piles, and I know this because I've got friends who are editors, is such crap that they really can tell by the end of the first page that they do not want to deal with you at all.
And I can speak to that as a...
Oh, you're an editor now,
too. ...newly minted editor. Yeah, we just released, as of this recording, we just released issue 2. So we're not just a flash in the pan, because there are a lot of magazines that don't make it past issue 1.
You are now officially a sizzle in the pan.
We are. And eventually we'll be steak, but that's...
or a good rolling boil.
Yeah. As a newly minted editor, I can attest to the fact that, we have received stories that I've read them in their entirety, even if... I can tell by the first paragraph or the first page, but these are short stories, so that's not as much of a slog.
Well, and these are the salad days. When your volume of submissions go up, you won't be able to do that anymore.
Right, right. So, you know, and I think actually for the upcoming issue, we're going to have to, you know, I actually told one guy who was like, you know, one of our slush readers who was like, you know, I just couldn't make it through the story. I said, well, then don't. You know, if you have to work, then it's not something we want to buy anyway, so... Right. Yeah, absolutely. You can tell within the first, sometimes the first paragraph, sometimes the first sentence, but, you know, easily by the end of the first page, whether or not it's something that you want to take over or take on as a publisher.
Right. And the people who send those in are usually people who are at the very beginning. And what better way to get them to send them to someone else than to say, we don't accept unagented submissions?
Yeah.
The idea that... But beyond that basic, the basic logic behind the ruse, the idea that publishers don't accept unagented submissions is empirically false, because over 40% of all first novels are bought unagented.
Wow! Now, see, that's a statistic I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, it's who was it? Did I can't remember if it was Jim Hines or Tobias Buckle or someone like that did a. Did a survey of everyone from all the new authors, at least in science fiction and fantasy, from 2009, and that was what they came up with.
Wow.
And Gail Carriger's first book was sold without an agent on multiple submission.
Nice. Well, see, that's a good example. I mean, for those that aren't familiar with her work, what's her website, or is it actually her
It's GailCarriger.com.
Okay. All right. I haven't read any of her, listened to any of her stuff, but, you know, from the opinions I have of friends and colleagues, that comes, her work comes highly recommended. So the fact that she got in the door, and she's a New York Times bestseller, as I recall. And then, as you said, Harry Potter.
Third book, yep.
I mean, as you said earlier, Harry Potter. I mean, you know, that was probably... unagented for the first book, too.
Don't know if it was or not, but the fact that it survived 19 rejections tells me that at least part of that trek was done without an agent.
Yeah.
Or she had a really, really persistent agent, which, hey, those guys are gold.
Yeah.
And I've met a couple of them. that agents are a weird crowd. The ones that really know their shit are really, really sharp people. And then there are the ones who think they're editors. Quite often because they used to be editors. Or the ones that are looking, that didn't used to be editors and don't know the agent game yet and are kind of new at what they're doing. And those tend more often to be walking disaster areas. But trying to figure out which one your agent is can be a bit of a trek.
Yeah, so I can definitely understand taking the first few swings by yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, is there a financial motivation for that, too? I don't know how the financial end of the whole agent, unagented thing works as far as you getting the money when payday comes along.
Well, it's a there's a complex set of trade-offs. An agent takes 15%. 10% if you're really good at negotiating with them. But a good agent can negotiate up your advance to such a point where they've more than earned their keep, financially speaking. However, a good lawyer can do that too, but the lawyer will take the money up front rather than as it comes in.
Gotcha.
And then advances are, of course, a whole other weird kind of thing as high interest loans, which is a whole other, they're high interest loans against productivity, and it's a whole other weird situation. And there's all sorts of strategic trade-offs as to whether you want to try to go for as low an advance and high a royalty rate as possible or vice versa. And that's the kind of stuff a very good agent will be able to help you decide how you want to deal with the trade-offs. But like with real estate agents, you also have to be cognizant of your agent's incentive structure.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever read Freakonomics?
No. Uh-uh.
There's a chapter in Freakonomics about real estate agents. And real estate agents get 10%. So when they get into a... at certain price breaks, real estate agents are less likely to hang on in a market to get you the best price. If they get an offer, say market value of the house is $230,000, $240,000, and your real estate gets an offer for $220,000, it's a little below market value, and the house has been on the market for a month.
Yeah.
The real estate agent then would pull, say if they're at 10%, just for easy math, they would pull $20,000 off that sale. That would be theirs. I don't think they actually take that much, but it's been a while since I read this.
Last time I dealt with real estate, it was like 6%. But
okay, 6%.
But 10%.
So they would take their cut from that if they advise you to accept the house. Now, you would expect, since they're acting in your interest and they're actually legally compelled to act in your interest, that they would tell you, wait, this offer is below market value, we should leave the house on the market for another 20 or 30 days because we will likely get a better offer. And that would be what you would think their fiduciary responsibility would be. What they actually normally do is say, take it.
Yeah,
because they've already got a month sunk into this house, and the amount more that you'll get may be another $10,000 or $20,000, but the amount more that they'll get is only a few hundred bucks.
Right,
and they don't want to do another month worth of work.
Absolutely.
And literary agents have the same kind of incentive structure because they're working on commission, and so when you're dealing with one, you need to be aware of their incentive structure, because in some situations their incentive structure and yours will line up really well, in which case you want them on your side. In other cases, your incentive structures might be at odds, in which case, without being sneaky, evil, or anything else, they may advise you to do something that's not in your best interest simply because they have other things to do that can actually pay their rent and you're not doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your advice...
That's when dealing with agents of any kind, whether they're sales reps for your small business or literary agents or real estate agents, you have to keep in mind what their incentive structure is. Act accordingly.
So your advice to people for our small slice of the universe that are involved in this ass-moving contest is to just keep cranking your stuff out there, get it out to multiple... Now, what about short stories... same advice, you know, send it to multiple.
No.
Okay.
No. Short stories I only ever do to one place at a time.
Now, why is that?
Well, first of all, the turnaround's faster, right?
Right. Arguably.
Sometimes in as little as a week, at worst as much as 6 months. But you've also got, you know, anyone who's writing has got dozens of short stories, or at least a dozen, that they're sending out. Uh-huh. It doesn't take very long to write a short story and send it out. You could do it in a few days if you needed to. You could do it in a day, which I did recently with a story called Eyes of Wax. A novel, when you're on fire, will take you a month. And when you're not on fire, it could take you a year.
Yeah.
To write it and clean it up enough to send it out. You put that much work into something and then wait for 6 month turnaround time every time you send it to market in a market where there's 45 major players, you're an idiot. And there's no better way to say that. You could theoretically, if the 45th person on that list, publisher on that list, wants that book, you could take 20 years to get there.
See, Dan, this is one of the things that I love about you. You are not afraid to call the obvious. Because, you know, that would probably never have occurred to me. And you're right. Now that it's been laid bare, if you don't see that or if you don't, you know, you're stupid.
It could take you 20 years to get there. And it's bad business. And this is an entertainment business. Yes, I know it's art, and I like doing art things too, but see my latest blog post for my rant about art.
I liked that. I liked what you had to say there. All right, so basically, you know, submit short stories one venue at a time, submit novels multiple venues at a time. Obviously, for short stories, agents are not an issue.
No.
You know, for your own stuff, I guess what your advice would be, and it would line up with, is it Heinlein's rules?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you have those committed
Heinlein's
to memory?
Heinlein's rules.
Do you have those committed to memory?
The man knew what he was talking about. I always miss one of them, so let me pull them up over here.
But while you're pulling those up, write your stuff and believe in it and get it as polished as you can and get it out. And I think...
What do you mean by polish?
Well, I mean, you know, write it until you're satisfied with it, I guess is what I'm saying. And edit it, you know, until you're satisfied with it. And if you've got beta readers, you know, get some other eyes on it. I think that's...
I have discovered that the longer I go, the less I rewrite. And there's a very good reason for that. The more comfortable I get in my craft, the more I recognize that a lot of the rewriting that I would normally do comes out of timidity rather than out of good judgment.
Okay.
The thing that makes you marketable are two things: the stories you tell and the voice you tell them in. The voice you tell them in is your voice, so it sounds boring to you.
Right.
And when you go through and polish, usually what people mean when they say that is they're cleaning up sentence structure to make it more grammatically correct. They're fussing over word choices to get exactly the right nuance in every paragraph. When you do that, what you're doing is you're getting rid of one of the two things that makes your writing unique. You're getting rid of your voice.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And the more comfortable you get with your voice, the less you're going to want to even go near it for fear of killing it. So what I do now is I'm an adder inner, so I'll actually usually, with the exception of a book like Down from 10, I actually had to go and do a cutting draft because it just went so long. But most of the time, I write through, I'll give it to my first beta, and she and I will go through it and figure out the parts where it needs expanding, where what I intended to say didn't come through, and it's basically notes to myself.
Uh-huh.
And I'll do that in a bit, so I'll have notes of additional sections to write, and then a continuity check, a spelling check, and the part that I don't do, but another one does, is the voice check. My beta reader will put in the margin. Here it sounds like the other character talking, that kind of thing.
Ah, yes.
Because,
yes,
like, I'll sometimes get stuck in one accent.
Right. Number.
But I don't do that.
Well, yeah, I guess you don't have enough distance from it to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I did as a beginner, my first book, my first novel ran 60 pages. And I started writing it when I was 8, and I finished it when I was 12. And because I wasn't writing, but because I would write a chapter and then I would spend a year polishing it.
That's not the kind of polishing I was talking
about. A lot of writers do that.
That's not the kind of polishing I was talking about. Yeah, that's.
But yeah, if you're talking about fact checking and
just doing some basic editing so, you know, get your stuff done and get it polished.
And timeline actually addresses that in the rules.
Well, let's hear the rules. I'm sure you've got them up by now.
Rule 1, you must write. Rule 2, you must finish what you write. That was a big one for me for a long time, too. Yes. I've got so many half novels around here, you wouldn't believe.
Oh, I believe.
Rule 3, you must not rewrite.
Yeah, see,
except to editorial order and Harlan Ellison's addendum, and then only if you agree.
Yeah.
Rule 4, you must put your story on the market. And rule 5, you must keep it on the market until it has sold. Rule 6, you must start working on something else. That's actually Robert Sawyer's addendum, that last rule.
That's a good addendum. And that's, I'll tell you, the ones that I had trouble with up until most recently, I guess would be the submitting, which I've finally gotten over. The whole not rewriting. That's something that with my longer pieces, I think is going to be a bit of a struggle. I mean, but yeah, you've got to go back and do a little bit of rewriting. But I suspect he's talking about the sort of rewriting that you were talking about, the years.
Yeah, I think so.
The years of going back and tweaking every last little millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that you've got.
Which both keeps it off the market and kills it at the same time.
Yeah.
There is a kind of rewriting that I still will occasionally do, and it's something that a lot of writers call redrafting. And this is what I did with Predestination. I actually wrote the book in 1999, and I got it to the point where it was the best I could do, and I sent it out. I actually sent that one out for submission. Got a handful of. Say I think I have 12 rejection notes on it, and put it in a drawer. Well, I went. Someone asked me, you know, oh, you wrote a novel once, didn't you? And I said, yeah, it was. You know, probably doesn't hold up anymore, but I really enjoyed it at the time. And he said, well, can I read it? And I said, yeah, sure, whatever. And I sent it to him, and he sent me a note back a few days later saying, you have to write this again. And I said, why? This is a piece of shit. You know, I've written a lot of stuff since then, and reading this, it just sounds so pretentious, so stilted. And he said, yeah, but it's pretentious and stilted, and you can almost barely, it makes your eyes bleed reading it, but the story is so good, I had to find out what happened. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. So I sat and read it through again, and I read it through with a red pen, and I basically crossed out everything that I would never want to write again. Everything that I was embarrassed about. and the manuscript went from 80 or 90,000 words down to about 5,000. 5,000 words with a bunch of notes. And I said, well then, why don't I rewrite it from scratch and just keep some of these, some of the style markers I liked, which is what I did. That 90,000 words was what is now Predestination and Free Will together. My redraft of Predestination, the one I podcast, is 127,000 words. So it was actually a ground-up redo from start. It wasn't rewriting an existing manuscript.
Gotcha.
That kind of rewriting is different than what he's talking about here, I think.
So that's sound advice.
More like having a second go at the same idea.
Yeah, yeah. So that's I think we agree that, that those rules are sound, as hard as some of them may be to follow.
Well, and here's the thing. A lot of people, I'll read them those rules, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, except for that rewriting thing, and except for the putting the story on the market and keeping it there until it's sold thing, I'm only going to put it out when it's ready. And by ready, they mean perfect.
And it's never going to be perfect.
As all new writers do. And that's, you know, people, you can go through these rules and you see at different stages of being a writer and you can see more and more people drop off. You must write. Okay, well, everyone does that. You must finish what you start. I think you lose probably about 70% of new writers right there. Takes a few years before we figure out, oh yeah, wouldn't it be nice to actually finish a story?
Yeah.
Then rule three, you must not rewrite except to editorial order and then only if you agree.
And only if they're going to pay you for it. I think that was
right.
Part of it,
well,
too.
And that was the thing about the editorial order. And this is, you know, another one of the other reasons that I am not using an agent to market the work. I'd be happy to work with an agent to negotiate the contracts, not so much to have them market the work, because I got offers from a couple of agents who said about Predestination, I would be happy to represent you, but you have to rewrite the book so that the characters are likable. That's not the kind of book it is.
Right. I can agree with that.
Moreover, the agent doesn't write a check. Yeah. I don't work for them.
Yeah.
They work for me. Your sales rep does not tell you to redesign your line.
Fair point.
Now, some writers like having agents that essentially also function as first betas, and that would count as like an extra service they offer. That's a service I don't want or need. I've got betas that are really, really sharp. I trust them. I've worked with them. They know my shit, and they know how to get to me when I'm not listening. My agent should be dealing with the contracts and mailing stuff out. I should not have to tickle his fancy in order to get him to do his job.
Right. They need to believe in what you do and what it is as
it stands. Oh, I don't give a shit. Here's where I'm going to sound completely crazy to about 90% of the audience. I don't give a shit whether the agent believes in what I do.
Okay.
I give a shit that they do their job.
Well, I'm just saying that in order to do their job, wouldn't they have to buy into what you're doing to some degree? They have to believe that you're marketable, sellable to somebody.
It's not rocket science to write a good query letter. You know, it's not like selling a car on the lot, right, where you have to convince someone that you really believe in it. Not in that sense. You don't have to like a story to be convinced that it'll find a good audience.
Well, that's – yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. We're not exactly saying the same thing, but we're agreeing, I think.
So
yeah.
But yeah, so I don't care if my agent likes my writing as long as the agent would sell it. But I, you know, the agents I went through that with were both really good agents. They're people with good reputations. And they're people who now represent friends of mine and do very well for them. They're good fits. So this is something, you know, something that some writers really want. It's something I'm not willing to put up with in an agent because I don't want that kind of filter between me and my market.
Right.
Right.
For some people, it works really well, and that's fine. But an agent does not write the checks. Therefore, by Heinlein's rules, the agent does not get to tell me what to rewrite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so keeping it on the market too, that's
yes. And there you lose a lot more writers. You must put your story on the market.
Because I'll speak to that.
The ass moving contest was specifically to get me past Rule 4.
Because I got one of my early rejections once I started doing this, and I was like, it must not be good. So I'm gonna keep it, and I'm gonna make it my baby, and I'm not gonna let it back out into the wilds again. And I really had to get over that.
Yeah, Scott Sigler was a very good influence on me for that.
Scott Sigler a good influence on somebody?
Oh yeah. Well, you have enough drinks with the guy, and you start talking shop with him. And for a while we were doing kind of semi-regular Bay Area podcaster pub crawls.
Yeah.
Which we don't do much anymore because they stopped being special. So people stopped showing up for them quite in as large numbers. And we all also got really busy.
Right.
But you sit down and talk to Scott and you get a few drinks in him. And he will rant endlessly about writers who are so concerned about their babies. He said, you know, you have to feel that way when you're writing because that's how you make good stuff. But once it's off your computer, and this is pretty much verbatim, he said, once it's off your computer, it's a product, it goes on the market, and you work on the next thing, or you will never be more than a dilettante.
And see, that right there is where you're going to lose some people, too, because they're like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is my art. This is not product. And I'm like, well, no, it's product because you want to sell it to somebody. And yep. Therefore, and it becomes a product.
And then you look at Heinlein's rules, and 50 years ago, Heinlein was saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Put your story on the market, keep it there until it's sold, and don't fuck with it.
Yep.
And, you know, this is what people who make a living at this say, which, you know, hey, some of these I'm still like a little about.
Right.
Particularly, you know, I still get that hankering to rewrite. I've developed the discipline not to, but I still get that hankering. I'm like, oh, it's not so much that the story's not ready, it's that I'm not quite ready to let go of it yet. But I'll say to myself, oh, the story's not ready yet. And so just one more pass through it, one more bit of polish. Right? No, it's a very bad idea. And you know, so I don't. You know, some of these things, they bristle at me, but these are the things that writers who actually do what I want to do, this is what they do. And the rest of the reservations, if this is what those people do, and I know it is because I've talked to a lot of them, then the reservations are the voice of inexperience and ideals about how the way things should work rather than the way things do work.
And see, that's what I think is key. And that's what I love about, that's one of the things I love about this whole podcasting thing. All these writers, you know, prior to now or prior to the last couple of years, it would have been very difficult for me to talk to other writers who are either where I'm at or just above where I'm at in terms of their number of sales, you know, or whatever, and to hear what's working. You know, because I haven't had opportunity to talk to, and may not have in the past had opportunity to talk to other writers to find out what actually works versus what I think should work. So mm-hmm. I really urge people who are listening to this, all five of you, that that
I bet you we could get this one spread far and wide.
I hope so. But, you know, I think that you should listen to not what I'm saying, not what Dan's saying, but to what Heinlein said. And to what you, Dan, are saying that other people have said who, you know, move their asses professionally and make their living doing this thing that we, a lot of us say we want to earn, you know, to make our living doing. In spite of the fact that everybody wants to tell us you can never make a living earning, you know, you can never make a living
yeah, that's,
writing.
That's one that we've definitely got to shoot in the fucking head.
Yeah, I want to do a separate conversation at some point on that because you and I have talked about
I'm
that
I'm on
in
a
the
tear,
past.
So why don't you do the outro and then let's go into that next conversation right now.
Yeah, I want to thank you for dropping some science and
science.
Well, you said it's more science than art. Earlier,
I did.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I was on a real tear.
This is the scientific
The scientific method.
Yeah, scientific method. So it was science, even if you didn't realize it was science. And so this concludes part one of what I hope will be a multi-part conversation on the ins and outs of how to get our asses moving. So thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you hopefully later this evening.